And welcome to
Unspooled Top 3.
I'm Amy Nicholson.
And I'm Paul Scheer. And this is the spinoff podcast, or I mean, just the special edition podcast, where we talk to amazing people about the three films that they would send into outer space. We have talked to directors, writers, actors, and today we are bringing back an Unspooled favorite. You might remember him from Double Indemnity. He is one of the most acclaimed writers in comics, winning 5 Best Writer Eisner and Harvey Awards in the last 10 years. His best-selling work with Sean Phillips on Criminal, Incognito, Fatal, and Fade Out has been translated all around the world to great acclaim. He also is known for creating one of the most famous characters in comic books, the Winter Soldier, and his latest book, Reckless, Book 3, which is a book I'm so enamored with. I love it so much. If you like classic detective stories, you will love this book. Comes out October 20th. It's the third in the series. Amy, I'm so excited to bring back Ed to chat with him about what his top 3 films are.
Welcome, Ed.
So, Ed, people who may or may not be familiar with you, you have this incredibly storied run as a graphic novelist, and you have written some amazing stories in the Batman universe. You've written some amazing stories in the Captain America universe. But I will say what I've been loving in the last, what is it, maybe 10 years or whatever, these new books, I'm talking about Fatal, Velvet, The Fade Out, Criminal, Pulp, and Reckless. They are just tour de force crime fiction. They're the things that I look forward to, the things that I love. They feel like they're written in many ways for me. I just love your characters. I love your style of writing. And I feel like we talked about this when you were on a previous episode, in the Double Indemnity episode. Like, you actually have a giant background in crime fiction. But I wanted to talk about Reckless today because your new book is coming out.
Yeah.
And it's the third one in this series. So tell it, get us up to date for people who don't know about Reckless.
Reckless is a thing I came up with in the early days of the pandemic lockdown. The entire comics industry shut down. Like, the printers were shut. In fact, a couple of the printers went out of business, and it's a huge disaster now. But all the comic stores shut down. The one distributor of comics was shut for 3 months. So there was this moment in time where I just thought, I don't know what comes after this. Like, will there be a comic book industry? And I was preparing to start like a monthly comic book that was going to launch that summer. And suddenly every idea, looking at it, like, I felt like the world was falling apart. We have this pandemic. We're all locked down. The industry is dying, it felt like. And I was like, what am I doing? And I, like, all these ideas for it, I just felt like they're all too dark. I don't want to write this. And I started going back to my bookshelves and reading, like, a bunch of old, like, Parker novels and, Lou Archer books. And I bought, like, a complete set of the Travis McGee books, which I'd never read, but were my dad's favorites. And I just started sort of jumping into this sort of what I would call like the pulp paperback hero genre. Like,
yeah.
Though Parker is ostensibly not a hero, but I love him. So he's my hero. But like, I remembered as a kid, like, just you'd go to the like Pick and Save or whatever, or Fed Mart, and they would have these walls of paperbacks, and they would, you know, my dad wouldn't let me read any of them, like The Executioner, and they would have like almost naked girls on the cover.
Yes, this is my, like, I remember having this experience where my grandparents brought me to a store like that, a Pick and Save, and they're like, you can pick any book. And I picked the book with what I thought was going to have some like nudity in the book. And I remember being kind of confused about what a blowjob was because it was being described. And so I was explaining it to my grandparents. I'm like, what do they mean is happening here? And they're like, give me that book. And
what
that
kind
book
of
was
job
like,
is this?
Yeah. I think the name of the character was like Mac Bolan or
Mac
something
Bolan,
like that.
The Executioner.
631 novels from Mac
yes.
Bolan. 631. Whoa.
And not all written by one guy, though. But there was this
trend.
Yeah, but
that's more than the Babysitter's Club. That could wallpaper a whole house. That's like insulation.
That's the kind of thing that I loved about it, though, was like it just you'd look and you're like, wait, this is book 75 and here's book 44. And it was like as a comic collector kid, I would see these and then I would show them to my dad and he's like, oh, those are for adults. And
yeah.
But I was just attracted to those lurid covers. And so my whole life, I've always loved just looking at the covers and reading about those books. And occasionally I'd get one and sneak one home and I'd be like, oh, these are kind of trashy.
Right.
But I found myself just kind of loving like the good versions of those like pulp hero kind of things and realizing like I mainly only have written about like the bad guys or people accused of crimes that, you know, I rarely have written good guy characters outside of like my Marvel and DC work. And even like the Winter Soldier, is he a good guy? Like, I don't know.
Right.
But I just suddenly felt like I don't know what's happening in the comics industry, if there'll be a comics industry on the other side of this. I don't want to start a single issue comic thing that I need comic stores to exist for. But I want to keep, you know, Sean Phillips and I have been working together for almost 20 years, just doing books nonstop. And I was like, we need to keep working or we're just going to lose our minds and we're going to get so far behind. And so suddenly, like, all of these ideas for, like, my version or our version of a pulp paperback hero just sort of came out of me. Like, I had the idea, like, Ethan Reckless is our hero. And all the books so far, the first three all take place in the 1980s, over the span of the 1980s. And the first one opens in 1981. And he's a guy who operates out of business, abandoned movie theater. That's like his office. And he spends all day. He's like a guy. We find out he's a guy who has this weird history. It's very similar to mine. He was a Navy brat whose dad was in military intelligence, but he's older than me. So he can be an adult in the 80s when I was like a teenager. And he was like a guy who was undercover for the FBI and, you know, in the Weather Underground. Like there were all these undercover like hippies back then, which I knew about from doing research for another project. And I just suddenly all these different ideas congealed into like, what would be my version of a pulp paperback hero? And I thought, well, he would operate out of a movie theater and not let anybody else come in. And he would watch movies all day and he would rarely take a case and he would go surfing all day. And maybe he would have some kind of brain damage or emotional inability to, you know, to connect with people. And so he's good at violence. And so it all just kind of came together really quickly. And I just emailed Sean and I said, how about we start this series of graphic novels instead? Because regardless of what happens with, you know, this shutdown that we were in at the time, like we'll be able to somehow publish a graphic novel. We can put it on Kickstarter. We can sell it to a regular book publisher if Image is somehow gone. And what turned out to happen was like after the 3-month shutdown, comic stores reopened. The week comic stores reopened, I believe our previous graphic novel Pulp came out and was like the biggest selling graphic novel of the year. And won like a bunch of awards and is the best selling thing we ever did. So us deciding to switch to graphic novels was actually a really smart thing for us. But we had no idea at the time because it was just like, I just wanted to keep moving forward and doing something that I felt was just some kind of pulpy fun. You know, I thought it would be easy. And of course, it's not easy.
But it appears easy in the sense that I feel like three books have come out in 2 years and they are
less
big.
Yeah, it's
less
10
than
months.
That.
10 months we've pumped out. The first one is 1981. The second one is 1985. And the third one takes place in 1988. And that one is Destroy All Monsters, it's called. And it focuses a lot on the relationship between Ethan and his sort of sidekick character, Anna, who's his projectionist slash assistant. Like, I really love her as a character. And I realized they've been friends at this point for 12 years in the history of the book, I wanted to spend a lot more time on like what their relationship was about and how, because a lot of my best friends in real life through my whole life have been women and, you know, in not a sexual way. Just like my best friends in high school were girls. And, you know, my best friend right now is my friend Allie. My wife is my other best friend, you know. I mean, I like you, Paul, but.
No, here, look, I'll take it.
Still, yeah.
But, I can't hold a flame.
I'm a girl. Hi.
Hi. You're on the list. Okay.
But no, I think what it's so fun about these books is they harken back to what we were talking about. Like this, like if you grew up, I think I grew up the same exact way. I devoured all the James Bond books when I was a kid. There was an element, and maybe it still is like this, but John McDonald, even the Fletch books, they were like, you would go to the bookstore and you would read these books and they would be fun and not disposable, but they were like watching a great Netflix show. You're like, oh, I can't wait for the next one. And here it was. And I feel like I'm missing out on that. And these books, you know, all your books have this energy that's so unique to them, but I love these books so much. So I'm excited that we'll get to meet her a little bit more in this.
Yeah.
And I mean, but are you thinking at all of like, have people been like, oh, I can be Ethan. I want to be Ethan. I want to make this into a movie. I want to make this into a TV show.
There's been definitely some interest. People worry about anything that's a period piece, I think, though I don't think the 80s feels like a real period piece. What I love about doing the period piece stuff is I get to sort of mine my own youth, but from the perspective of today. And a lot of it is written from the sort of environmental perspective of like looking back at all these things that have been in the news since the 70s that we've all just completely ignored until the planet is on fire. It's like you could find articles back in the 70s talking about global warming, you know, and scientists would be saying, oh, this is a thing we really need to start dealing with 45 years ago. But, you know, now we're like, now Seattle's like 128 degrees, you know, so it's like, oh, yeah. So I get to sort of talk about that and talk about like when I was a kid, we used to come up to L.A. all the time from San Diego to go see like punk shows and stuff. And so,
yeah.
I get to talk about like this sort of forgotten LA in some ways. Like I try to work on that stuff a lot. It's just really interesting. I like you said, like there was a disposable nature to that kind of serialized character where you're just coming back to see what this person gets into next. I really wanted to lean into that disposable nature. And I found instead that I was creating something where I could put more of my own sort of personal experiences and thoughts into this character. Like a lot of his history is my history, which is weird, but also I could do sort of like what they did in Chinatown, where you look back at like a crime that was totally public when it was happening that has affected everything since then. There was this whole thing that never gets talked about anymore. There was this corridor where they tore down where they were going to tear down all these houses. And then there were all these lawsuits to prevent people from tearing them down because they didn't want the freeway to run through. So for a decade and a half, I think, there was just this like 15 or 20 mile period of just like empty houses. And that was where a huge amount of the crime in LA congregated. And it's partly responsible for turning like South LA into what South LA became. And it's just completely overlooked. We all talk about like the CIA, Iran-Contra, crack, all of that stuff. But we never talk about this highway going through that actually affected all of this stuff. And like, I really love that aspect of doing the period piece stuff. So I really hope that, you know, that we've had some serious interest from, you know, some big producers and stuff. And so I hope we'll get somebody. I would actually love for the Sebastian Stan to play Reckless.
I
think he's perfect for it. And also it'd be just amazing because he's the Winter Soldier.
I love that you would keep it in the family. I have two questions for you because then we have to get to the business of some movies and some good movie talk. But who would be, and this is a conversation that Amy and I have a lot, who would be your perfect Jack Reacher? Do you read Jack Reacher? Do you have a thought on this?
Yeah, I am a Reacher fanatic. I mean, if anything, Reckless is sort of my version of that Reacher. I actually tried very hard to get the job to write the second Jack Reacher movie. I went through, I think I made it through to the second round of interviews. I never got to the Tom Cruise interview or anything.
It would have been so much better if you had written it.
I know.
I mean, I can't say that that's that for sure at all. Talented people worked on those movies and they are not perfect. But I am a, you know, I'm a Reacher fan. Who would be my perfect Jack Reacher?
Amy has a choice, and I want to see, but I want to hear yours before we reveal Amy's choice. But yeah, like I want you to go in blind.
He's the Witcher now, but he would have been perfect.
Ooh, Henry Cavill.
Henry Cavill would have been a perfect Jack Reacher.
I really like that.
But he's also the perfect Witcher, where you realize, like, oh, he brought out his inner Clint Eastwood. And I wouldn't want to mess up the Witcher. I think the guy that they got for the Amazon show from Titans, like, he looks the part. We'll see if he can actually pull it off. He looks young to me.
But that's kind of what I feel like, too. I mean, Amy, do you want to reveal your pick?
I mean, I feel like there's really only one person for the job, and that's Michael Shannon.
I mean, the only time we've seen Michael Shannon be like buff, he's scary all the time. Like, Michael Shannon could pull off the attitude and everything, but Michael Shannon's like not that. He's got to be like late 40s or something. He's not, you know, he doesn't want to spend 4 hours in the gym every day to try to become Jack Reacher.
Oh, I don't think Jack has to be that big. I think he just knows how
he
to
has
kill.
To beat up I mean, an entire
no.
But he has to be able to
Jackie
out
Chan
eight
used to do that.
Berets.
Jackie Chan could beat up
ripper.
80 Green Berets.
He's got to be throat ripping and taking bullets to the chest, and his muscles are so big that the bullet doesn't go through. Come on, that's a scene
in
the book.
No human could match that description. No, the thing with Jack Reacher is that he has to be unnervingly and giant. And I don't know, I've had this image in my head ever since I actually saw.
Is he tall?
He is tall. And more than that, he's big in unexpected ways. Like, this is weird, but the image I always get is, like, I had to go to a panel that he was on actually about Superman when he was General Zod. And I was laughing because, like, you know, it was like everybody in the cast and crew, like, lined up on this conference table. And they were all normal humans. And then Michael Shannon's head, just his head, is like twice as big as everybody else. Just gigantic, just looming in a way where you're like, his jaws are massive.
Well,
his
head
hands
is the only
massive.
Part of him that's actually in that movie. So, like, everything else in that movie
it's
is
true.
There's like a green screen costume that he was wearing.
But you just realize he has a sense of scale that is unmatched in human Earth.
How
plus,
hilarious,
you're supposed
though,
to be blondish.
We each picked a character from the Superman.
Right?
I totally forget that Henry
what
Cavill
I'm
is
saying
Superman.
Is like, he looks so much bigger even than Cavill.
you pick Michael Shannon, I pick Henry Cavill. That's amazing. Who's Paul's choice?
You know, I'm kind of, I don't have a horse in this race, but I would say the height is the issue for me. I can't figure out the tallness of the body. Like, you're right, that's...
he's supposed to be like 6'4 or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's a part of me that
would
say, like...
My dad was like one of the heads of Naval Intelligence and was 6'4, but he was never buff. He could never beat up a team of like, green
I mean,
berets.
Michael Shannon, 6'3". We're not far
I mean,
off here.
I think I would... there's a part of me that would be like, I like Tom Hardy, but I feel like he's got a good intensity to him, and I feel like you've seen him beefed up, and he
but
has that.
But he's a little
like,
short, isn't
he's
he?
Short.
Isn't he
I know
pretty?
He's short.
I don't think Jack Reacher should be that pretty.
Yeah, Tom Hardy doesn't look like an investigator to me. He doesn't have that sort of. He looks more like a brute, like a I will kick your ass kind of guy. Like,
right.
You wouldn't want to be the asshole who drunkenly wanders up to Tom Hardy at a bar and is being too familiar about him being a star and trying to, like, he
right.
may kick your ass.
The only thing I would like to quickly say is I've never been more disappointed and more excited in, because I love this genre of the investigator and everything like this. I've never been more disappointed in a movie than Spencer for Hire in a time where I've watched so many movies during the quarantine and everyone was kind of scratching an itch that I wanted. And I was like, this is great. That movie sucked. And I feel like we have not talked about it. I think we have not been able to dive into it. It's such a beautiful franchise sitting there. And for it to be just so half-assed, not funny, not interesting. It's like it was just sitting weirdly in the middle. I don't know why it was so not good. It was such a bummer.
That one bummed me out a bit too, but I'm going to be a little bit nicer because I don't want Mark Wahlberg to show up at my house.
No, I know. Look, Mark Wahlberg can do it. I feel like there are forces against him that made it not
weirdly. It was a weird whiff. Like it should have been. It should have been a really fun movie. Like that team should have been able to, you know. And I don't
everybody.
Know. I don't know why it. You know, I mean, come on, you work in the industry. It's nearly impossible to make a movie that's not good.
Well, you know, I mean,
it's impossible. It's almost impossible to make one that's good, but it's just as hard to make one that turns out not to be. And you don't know.
I think you're right. I think the thing that I always wrestle with is when you have so many books to pull from and so much source material, it is amazing that sometimes the weirdest ones are the ones that we focus on. Like, let's not follow the book. Why? Let's not go against. Let's go against what people like about this and create our own thing. I hate that. But anyway,
that always is to me. That just says like someone took a job because they were excited about it, but they really want to do their own thing instead. And I've had that happen to so many adaptations of my own stuff that don't end up getting made. And I'm like, did you not read or like the book? Like, why?
Just want the IP. We want that name.
The name.
I mean, I think the problem with Spencer for Hire is that they just didn't make it Boston enough. That's completely a joke. That is completely a joke. I have never seen a movie that was more desperate to be Boston.
It needed Donnie Wahlberg and Ben Affleck directing.
Now, Ed, before we get into your top three, we have some unfinished business because you and I were chatting and I was telling you that we had just done an episode on Inception and we're talking about the reception to Inception. And you said, oh my gosh, I have an amazing theory about Inception. And I feel like my theory is right. And I said, stop, don't tell it to me. I wanted you to tell me and Amy on the air what your theory on Inception is because you can reveal anything you want, but you feel like you are the closest to the truth of the series.
I mean, it's up to Christopher Nolan to not reveal that I'm correct. but I do feel like, and I have said this many times, I have a lot of friends who I've argued with about this theory. Some of them saying even that ruins the movie. Then I don't even care. You know, like I will fight people about this theory because I think that movie is, for one thing, I love, by the way, how much thought you guys put into it looking back at it like 11 years later, like, and both appreciated. I felt like Amy appreciated it a lot more than she did originally, maybe.
Yeah.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Though still having a lot of problems with it that I saw people pointing out at the time. I would be curious what its like Rotten Tomatoes score is. It's probably really high. But I always felt like it was a little bit misunderstood because just like I feel like Nolan is in general a little bit misunderstood. A lot of people think his movies, and Amy is one of them, think his movies are basically cold and calculating and have no emotional center in them. Like I love movies that have nothing but emotional center and I could give a shit about the plot. Usually I think Nolan's movies are intensely emotional.
I
do not think it's understood completely. I mean, The Prestige is a heartbreaking movie. Memento is a heartbreaking movie that is also very, very clever. And I think probably still his best movie. I don't know. But Inception, to me, is the culmination of his own obsession. And everything he's made since Inception is like, I feel like he hit this peak of like, okay, I've explored this theme. And the theme is a main character who is terrified about what their life would be without their wife. And I do not know Christopher Nolan. I've met Christopher Nolan once. We had a really great interaction once at a panel that was really where I got a laugh out of him. And that was like the highlight of my year,
God.
I think.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard him laugh.
No, it was great. It was one of my finest moments. And
is it like a Barrett? Like, ho, ho, ho. Is it like a British?
No, it was a quiet. I mean, he was on stage, so I was in the audience, and I said something, and someone yelled out spoilers, and I said the movie came out 10 years ago, and someone said, "What about Blu-ray sales?" And I said, "Oh, like he needs the money," and he laughed. But I think his theme is the fear of the loss of this person that is everything to the main character. And I mean, look at Christopher Nolan's life. I think he got married in film school. His wife produces all of his movies. Everybody I know who knows either of them just says she's the greatest person they've ever met. Everybody loves her. I believe what Inception is really about, and this gets to the crazy Kubrickness of how Christopher Nolan views art and films, and, you know, I'm projecting this onto it, obviously. Like, as Paul and you said, the great thing about this movie is you can project your own interpretations onto it. I believe there is no layer of Inception that is not a dream. I believe the entire movie is communicating from Christopher Nolan to the audience. It is a dream that a man is having the night before he has to tell his children that their mother died.
Wow.
Okay, go on.
There is no layer in that movie that is not a dream. The one layer that's supposed to be reality, right? It's all tricking you not to think this, right? The thing with the spinning top at the end, so you're like, is he back in the world or is he in a dream? None of that matters. The reality level of that movie has more shit that happens to you in a dream than any of the dream levels do, right? He's trying to hide from the cops, and suddenly, oh, I'm the only white person in here, and they're going to spot me immediately. He's trying to, like, get away, but the alley gets smaller. Like, everything that happens in the reality part of it, and you came close to pointing this out, Amy, everything that happens in the reality level is something that would happen to you in a dream. You're thinking about a person, and they appear. Like, he's trying to get away, and the guy pulls up with the car. Like, every single layer of that movie is another layer of a dream. And here is the key to it. So they're falling backwards in the top layer, right? And each layer that they go into is affected by the previous layer, but moves in slower time. This is what we're told. All of that is fucking horseshit. It's all a dream. When they're falling backwards, the next layer of the dream suddenly goes into they're in zero gravity, right? That's why they have that amazing zero gravity fight scene, which it's all just beautiful, right? So how come the layer below that, they're fucking skiing and having a James Bond movie? There is gravity there.
Right.
There is no gravity when they're falling. When they're floating in zero G, they're in a James Bond movie in the next layer down. Like, come on. No, that's a dream too. There's no dream logic that connects those two. The whole movie is a dream. Every single thing. Because when you're having a dream, and you talked about this, like Paul has serial dreams, it sounds like. You have dreams more like me, where one thing kind of moves to the next. And I have recurring dreams, actually, which is sort of tragic because a lot of them are about like being sent to prison and stuff.
So you show up in a dream prison, and you're like, oh, I know this place so well.
Yeah, it's that. Or I'm being chased by the cops and I'm like, I can't. It's like those frustration dreams where you're trying to call the one person to like come pick you up and you keep hitting the wrong number.
Yes. All the time. Wait, do you have a guilty subconscious?
Okay, of course I do. I was a teenage, I was a teenage drug addict and criminal. This came up during our last podcast. I think, you know, I never completely can escape the guilt of things that I feel bad about. So I believe that whole movie is a work of art that is someone expressing their love for their wife and someone expressing...
I love
the
this.
Worst thing that could possibly happen is having to wake up and tell your children that their mother is gone, because what would your life ever be after that? And I think to me, it's the most moving thing.
So him going out to see the kids is basically him.
Yeah. It doesn't matter that they're confidence, not the same kids or that their shoes are different or any of that. All that bullshit is to get you to start asking a million questions about what's dream, what's not dream. But I believe that the movie is itself, because also, like other people pointed out, there were articles that came out at the time, the heist crew is exactly like putting together a film crew.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're scouting a heist. It's just like scouting a location. Everybody has their different jobs. There's a lot of exposition. Well, when you're hiring someone for a thing, you have to explain like how this works. All of that stuff is great. A filmmaker like him, of course, every facet of every character is just another piece of him in his dream. So, of course, it's a film crew.
Right.
Inception is brilliant because it's like reading a novel or something where you can walk out of that and argue about what the movie was.
That's what I love about it, too.
So it is a singular experience on a lot of levels.
I mean, what I find romantic about that is the idea of a man and his wife making a whole love letter to her. And maybe she knows, maybe she doesn't.
Yeah, maybe she doesn't even know.
And him also.
Until she's hearing this podcast right now.
Right, that's it. But him also being such an intensely private person, because he very much gives off that radar, that porcupine radar, that he can't put anything in this relationship that will make it obvious to people. So he can't actually have a human seeming connection between, I believe, Dom Cobb and Mal, well, because he doesn't want to put any like details away. Like, but which is why I struggle with that movie, because like
finds her like when she's going to kill herself because she thinks she's still in the dream. They check into a room, but when he looks out the window, she's like at the building across the street. She's not on the ledge right outside the window. She is she's across from him. They're looking at each other. All of this is a dream. There is no layer of inception that is reality.
That's actually really key. You're right. How do I never think about that? How does she get from one ledge to the other? Does she shimmy on the telephone wire? That makes
no sense. Is it a cul-de-sac building?
Is this a crazy thought? Is Elliot Page a younger version of his wife? Or like some sort of like she's helping him address, like the younger version's also there to help him get through it? I don't know. Maybe.
I mean, it's who is anybody in a dream.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like they're either like I dream about people who really exist sometimes, but then suddenly I'm them and I'm doing something. So I don't think about that stuff too much. Yeah. I noticed by the second viewing that there was no level that wasn't a dream, that the reality level felt more dreamlike than the next level down. Actually, and then the third level is just a fucking James Bond movie. And obviously, Chris Nolan wanted to make a James Bond movie.
Well, I think that this, I love what you're saying, which is like the movie is so personal that that it's literally based on his life. But I also just like the idea too. And Amy, talking about this with you, like you say, it lacks emotion. I would say that a lot of dreams, you don't wake up like full of emotion, but a lot of times full of anxiety. And there's a lot of those issues as well. So I think that that's what it's kind of playing on too, emotionally on that level. This is a great theory that I love. It kind of took my breath away. I'm glad I waited to hear it live. I feel like Amy, you're also at least considering this theory.
I am considering it very strongly, because then it helps me grapple with the fact that I think he can't give us almost anything about the actual relationship, that we don't actually see them ever have any conversations. You know, we really don't see like Mal or Dom ever talk.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have no sense of what draws them
together.
Those are
not real people.
Yeah. It makes sense in the way of
revealing.
Cobb is named
after the guy from his first movie. You know,
Cobb
was the guy in his first movie too, who was the thief who turned out to be the bad guy at the end. Spoilers for 25 years ago.
All right, so now we've gotten two giant things out of the way. We've talked about the most important things about the show, which is who would be the greatest Jack Reacher, what's the theory behind Inception, and now we get to your top three. Ed, we've love having you on the show, and I feel like you have such a great knowledge of film that we thought it would be really interesting to hear the three films that you would put up to be saved.
And what really strikes me, like especially after the conversation that we've had, is that each of these films, they are romance. And they do really each evoke like a specific distinct era in time, which makes me really feel like your picks are kind of like inceptioning me into your head even further than this conversation did. You know, I kind of want to start it chronologically, just because the last time that you were here and we were talking about Double Indemnity, you know, we really got into like, you know, this, it was our first example of even doing a noir on the show. We have kept Double Indemnity on our API list, but with kind of an asterisk, only because we are thinking we haven't gotten to fully explore film noir yet. And do we just want to put the first one that we've really ever seen on the list? And so we've been wondering what might knock Double Indemnity out. And here you come with a film noir called Out of the Past.
Look at all the angles. You know Witt and you know how far he can reach. So just pay me off and I'm quiet. But use cash. Don't try to pay me off with pitch handed to you with this cheap piece of baggage. I was hoping you'd do this.
Okay. Give us your Out of the Past pitch. Why this movie?
Out of the Past is the noir movie that I, when I saw that at a noir festival when I was like 16 years old or something, it was one of the first times I saw one of those movies where I didn't find any of it to be corny. Like I really felt the way, I mean, it's beautifully filmed. Some of the greatest cinematography from that era, actually, you know, the sets and the location shooting is all amazing. Robert Mitchum is narrating a story like in the future about a thing that happened to him. And he's basically telling you about his sort of hard luck, broken heart. And it is a story about a private eye who is hired by a gangster to find the woman who shot him and stole like a couple hundred grand and ran off to Acapulco. Robert Mitchum takes this case from Kirk Douglas, who was in his second feature role in a film, I believe, and goes down and immediately falls in love with Jane Greer, who is the greatest femme fatale of all time, other than maybe the woman from Crisscross. It is the quintessential like broken heart story. Like you really feel the way this guy throws away his whole life, that he falls in love with the woman he's supposed to catch. They go on the run together. They're hiding out in San Francisco. They're going to the tracks and getting seen by people and having to like escape town. Like he spends it feels like a year or more like on the run with this woman being lovers. And, you know, and then when they're caught up to, she murders a guy in cold blood that he wouldn't have killed, and they break up and he goes and hides out and just becomes another person and starts a new life and is, you know, dating this nice girl in this small town. And then we get to where the movie began, which is where like a gangster who knew him from a long time ago pulls up to this gas station where he works under this fake name. It's a story about like doomed love and sort of unrequited love. And it does one of the things that I think noir films can do best, or noir stories in general, that they rarely do, which is there is a secret between the viewer and the movie at the end. Like she asks his sidekick character, this deaf kid, if his character, like after all the bad stuff has happened, when they've all come back together and Kirk Douglas has tried to get revenge and Jane Greer has gone crazy, and I don't want to ruin the whole movie for everybody, but there's this deaf kid in the small town, and the fiance, the nice girl from the small town that Mitchum was, you know, was sort of his redemption girl, she says, "Did he really ever love me?" And the deaf kid shakes his head so that she can go on with her life. And we know he really did, and that he's sacrificing himself so that she will be able to move on and have a real life. And this deaf kid somehow knows this is the right thing to do. And it's just this beautiful moment of, it's heartbreak, but also like a happy ending in a weird way.
Very Casablanca-esque.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Very, you know, much. Yeah.
That sounds just gut-wrenching. I haven't gotten to see this yet. Now it's high on my list because I realize that Robert Mitchum is an actor I need to know a lot more about. I've only seen a handful, and like no human being has a face like Robert Mitchum, but Robert Mitchum.
It has the greatest line of, it may have been written by, it has ghost rewriting by James M. Cain, who actually wrote Double Indemnity. He's an unlisted screenwriter on the movie. It has one of the greatest lines of dialogue of all time, which I believe is like the title of a Mitchum biography, Baby, I Don't Care. She's basically right before they kiss for the first time, she's trying to confess to him about things that she's done. And he just shakes his head and says, "Baby, I don't care." And then he kisses her. And it's like, if you as a young
person... By the way, that book is called Baby... Oh, I was going to say, I thought the book was going to be called Baby, I Do Care. But you're right. It is called Baby, I Don't Care.
Baby, I Do Care.
I mean, speaking of dialogue, I think that brings us really well to our next film, Diner.
Where's that roast beef?
Don't ask me this anymore, Muldown. Yes.
You gonna finish that?
Yeah, I'm gonna finish it. I paid for it. I'm not gonna give it to you.
No. If you're not gonna finish it, I would eat it. But if you're gonna eat it, you're gonna...
What do you want? Say the words.
No, go ahead. You're gonna eat it. You eat it. That's all right.
Say the words. I want the roast beef sandwich. Say the words and I'll give you a piece.
You know, there is a before Diner and after Diner, and Diner has like really seeped into so much of culture. You could draw lines to Apatow, Seinfeld, this idea of, you know, casual conversation.
Tarantino.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's so many places it goes. So talk to me about why
because
this movie
this
holds
dialogue.
Up for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This movie, I think it came out when I was in 10th grade, so I'd have been like 14, and I was a Navy brat. I moved around every couple of years until I was about 8 or 9 years old. Because of this, I don't have, you know, as a child, I didn't have a lot of long-term friendships. When I was going to high school, like everybody that I was in high school with had known each other since they were little kids, or almost all of them. And they had these relationships that I was an outsider from. So when I watch Diner, it's about these five kids who grew up together and are still best friends, you know, 10 something years after high school, and they're all coming back for the wedding of one of their friends from childhood. And it's just the camaraderie of these people. And every single person in the movie went on to be a huge star. You know, Mickey Rourke, Steve Guttenberg.
Thank you for listing him second.
Kevin Bacon. Thank you for listing him second.
But this is very much like, you know, Mickey Rourke, you know, this idea that there are movies in this time, and maybe I'm lumping them all together, but like The Outsiders and Diner that basically launched groups of people. And we talk about this a lot in the show. Like, one of the things I think that's so effective in good filmmaking is not having super recognizable people, because I think you actually fall in love with them a little bit more and start to then you want to see them again. But like, there is something really, you can find this group of friends. And I think we saw that with, you know, Hangover and Bridesmaids and, you know, and Superbad. Like, they're people that you may not, you know, they haven't had a chance to really shine. And then all of a sudden you get to just be like, these are my next new favorite people.
Yeah. This also had Tim Daly before he went on to be a TV star. You would have thought coming out of that movie that he was going to be the big movie star out of all of them. But it was Kevin Bacon, actually, and Mickey Rourke.
And Daniel Stern,
who was already big-ish as a side character actor because of Breaking Away. So I got to meet Daniel Stern at my friend Anders' movie premiere for Game Over Man. And I waited until all the younger people had taken their selfies with him to tell him how much Home Alone meant. And I walked up to him and I said, "Hey, I know you've been, you know, bombarded here. I just want to say, I know what's on the flip side." And he looked at me and he's like, "You're a Diner guy." And it was just one of the greatest couple of minutes of my life. I was like, "Yeah, Diner, Breaking Away." I'm like, I used to, my friend Dave Clowden and I used to take a VCR and a TV to the Denny's at Texas and El Cajon in San Diego, 1984. And we would watch Diner in the booth at our diner and have people standing around, and we would do every single line of dialogue and ruin the movie for everybody else. Like, we were like that guy in Diner who's doing Sweet Smell of Success.
Feeling this was a movie like that for you. I don't know why. I had the vibe.
But it is, what's amazing about it to me is it's a movie, too, about men who don't understand women. Because there's that great line after Mickey Rourke meets the woman who's riding a horse. And her name is something Chisholm. And she says, like, the Chisholm Trail. And then she rides away. And he looks at I think, Kevin Bacon. And he's like, "What fucking Chisholm Trail?" And then the other one is like, "You ever get the feeling there's something going on that we just don't know about?" And that's what that whole movie is about. It's about a bunch of guys who grew up just being guys. Now, one of them is about to get married. He doesn't even know why he's getting married. And they grew up in this sort of diner culture, and they don't understand women at all. It is one of the best, like, camaraderie friendship movies ever made. It 100% changed everything that came after it. There would be no Seinfeld. There would be no Reservoir Dogs. There, you know, I mean, the list goes on of people who were like, oh, you can do dialogue like that. Like Paul Reiser. Paul Reiser was in that and apparently ad-libbed probably 20% of his dialogue in those scenes. Like him and Gutenberg would just, there's an argument about a roast beef sandwich that apparently the studio argued for them to take out because they're like, it doesn't move the plot forward at all. And Barry Levinson was like, the roast beef sandwich is the entire story. Because I mean, that says everything about their relationship, about how they treat each other.
I have to say two things here. One, I went to college in Oklahoma, which means I did go on two dates with a Chisholm, because the Chisholm Trail did go near there. And yes, he did say Chisholm like the trail. That is absolutely a thing. But it never occurred to me that maybe he was making also a diner joke. Huh, I have to chew on that for a while. Also, this movie, you know, is a little sacred to movie critics because of Pauline Kael.
Yeah.
You know that Pauline Kael, she has gotten picked apart many times on the show for saying crazy things, even though I love her deeply. This is one of the examples where, like, they weren't sure about how this movie was going to get distributed, if it was going to get distributed, if it was going to be any good. Like, they had got cold feet before it came out.
Yeah, they didn't want to release it until she
yeah,
said she was going to write a review no matter what.
Exactly. Apparently, so, like, one of the producers snuck her a print of the movie while this whole debate was going on. And she told the studio, like, listen, I'm going to write a glowing review of this movie, whether you release it or not. Kind of put her critical pen to their head.
Yeah.
And as a critic, that's one of the things you just dream of. You'll, like, be in a scenario where you can make that happen. Like,
we're dreaming
of that someday. Like, come on, man. Like, let me help.
It is. I mean, I still think it's a masterpiece to this day. If it were a genre movie, people would still talk about it a lot more. I think if there was a heist in the middle of it or something.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. The thing is, it's just a couple. It's like a week in the life of these guys. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartwarming. It's like everything that you love about Mad Men and what Mad Men says about life is in these 2 hours, basically.
Well, and I think that there is something about a movie like this where also it's the time that you saw it and who your contemporaries are. Mm-hmm. And because other people have done it in their own style and whatever you've fallen in love with. And for me, that movie was, and I love Diner, but Reservoir Dogs was the movie that kind of blew my mind, right? And that was like, oh my God, that's my thing. And then, you know, I think there's always an element of, you find that, but without this. This is the treasure map to lead you to where it was originally started.
Yeah.
I think that's it still really does hold up, even though attitudes change and things like that. But there's a nature and there's a really fun thing. I told you before, Jason Reitman, for his directing project one time, had the cast of The League do Diner. And it was really fun for us to go in there because I think it was a very astute observation. Like, oh, yeah, you could put any big ensemble together and it'll have like a better vibe than just a bunch of strangers. And
it's a messed up movie in a lot of ways, too. Obviously, Mickey Rourke sticks his dick into a box of popcorn so he can win a bat that a girl will have his dick at the movies. It's like, ugh.
I know we're gonna have to have one of those Revenge of the Nerds conversations when we do finally get to this, because I think we should because we actually haven't even done a Barry Levinson film yet on this list, and it's always hard reconciling with the things that people thought were funny there, but I
will also say I'll take this over American Graffiti any day of the week.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
100%. I mean, 100%.
That guy's gone.
All right. And I love American Graffiti.
But let's go to our third film.
Our third film.
Like I said, we haven't done a Barry Levinson, but we did this year talk about the director of the next film that you picked. You picked 2046 by Wong Kar-wai, who we have talked about a few months ago in Chungking Express.
If 2046 is, I think, Wong Kar-wai's best movie. A lot of people would argue with me that I'm crazy for saying that, especially since it was made right after In the Mood for Love, which most everybody thinks is his best movie. I love In the Mood for Love. And in fact, it would, you know, I would fight these two movies to see. But 2046 to me, it captures so much of a feeling of the aftermath of a bad breakup, or that the thing that crushed you. Like, it reminds me the most emotionally of how I felt from like age 25 to like age 30 after the I had had like a very significant, you know, that one really young significant relationship that you have, and it had gone and it had ended poorly, and I was heartbroken for a good 5 years, and everything that I did in the course of those 5 years was somehow me trying to recover from all the girls that I dated. Sorry if any of you are listening to this, were somehow me trying to recover from this huge, enormous heartbreak that, you know, is one of those things that in some ways you never 100% get over. You just kind of one day you wake up and you're like, oh, I don't feel that way anymore. Right. And you can move on with life. And, you know, then I met my wife and I've been married for 21 years now. But I remember vividly that feeling of crushed and nothing matters and just throwing myself into my work. And, you know, you could meet these amazing people, but somehow not be able to really connect with them, or, you know, because you just can't connect with yourself. And I feel like that movie is the greatest unrequited love movie that's ever been made. I think it's got the best visuals of anything he's ever made. I know it's a companion piece to In the Mood for Love. I actually saw them in opposite order, which might be why I like 2046 more. But I think I also like it more because it's more challenging in its structure. It really jumps around in time a lot. It feels very literary. It reminds me a lot of something like a Milan Kundera book, like The Book of Laughter and Forgetting. Where it feels like a bunch of short stories all about the same character that are intertwining. I think I'm going to probably mispronounce her name, but Zhang Ziyi, it is the best performance of her career ever, I think. And anything that, like, any moment that she's on the screen is like burned into your retina. You cannot understand why he is not in love with her. And when she meets him at the end of the movie to ask him for money, and then she gives him all his money back for all the nights they slept together, as if somehow, it's just, it's so heartbreaking, and you feel so crushed for her. And yet, as a guy, I completely understood how Tony Leung is one of the greatest actors of all time. Everybody in this movie is phenomenal. Gong Li, in her brief appearance, is, you know, just this mysterious gambler woman. But every moment of this movie that it can just carries the weight of heartbreak and longing and this desire to go back to the past and be able to fix things, and which carries over from In the Mood for Love, which, you know, In the Mood for Love ends with this coda that is translated underneath, apparently. The original translation was a little bit improper, but the translation underneath is very close to the end lines of The Great Gatsby about this idea of paddling back to the past. He's talking about he's always looking at the past as if it was a dusty window he could break through and somehow get back to. And this movie, for me, obviously it's a sequel to that. He wasn't done with that idea yet, but it's also got this weird sci-fi element of the story that he's writing that is, I guess, more related to Chinese culture and Hong Kong culture, because 2046 was 1 year, was the last year that Hong Kong would be under self-rule originally, which has turned out to be bullshit. So that's a tragedy in its own. But there was an extra meaning for, if you knew that it was like the idea that this sci-fi future was also the last year that Hong Kong would be Hong Kong too. So it just feels like it really carries these themes in this amazing way. There's some visual stills in that, you know, I still look at to this day when I'm trying to compose things. I'll look at some imagery, just her smoking a cigarette on the edge of the building, and you're like, I don't know if it was Christopher Doyle or the other cinematographer who shot that part of it, but I know they took 4 years to make the movie, so there's two different cinematographers, but it is, I think, the outside of Darius Kanji, you know, Christopher Doyle is my favorite living cinematographer. If he's, I don't know if he's even alive now. but
living or zombified.
How yeah, living or zombified. But it is,
actually, I hearing you say that, I'm thinking like, my gosh, if you just took all the stills of this film and assembled them, it would just feels like a graphic novel. Because yeah, of the structure just being so wild, you know, the four timelines, it's impossible to even describe. It feels like fiction that you could hold on to even better.
There's no storyboards. Right. That's amazing. There's practically no script. You know, it's such an artistic expression. Wong Kar Wai, you know, I mean, everything he makes looks amazing and is captivating to me. Other than maybe Blueberry Nights, which
that was terrible.
But I mean, this movie to me, I saw it. I couldn't get other people to watch it with me. I didn't care. I watched it like 10 times. I still think when I think about like what would be a movie I would show to someone to express what heartbreak feels like, and it would be that movie.
I love this. These are great, great picks. And I feel like they're also picks that I don't know if everyone is incredibly familiar with the exception of Diner.
Most people aren't familiar with Diner, though. The younger crop of filmmakers has not seen it. Like, a lot of people I talk to have not seen it. They've seen things. And I wonder how it will feel to them. It's like when I, you know, first discovered, like, Knute Hampson, who was, like, a big influence on, like, Hammett and Hemingway and Fitzgerald and all the, and when you start reading him, you're like, oh, this just kind of feels like that stuff. Like when something's so influential, like I wonder if they would look back at it and just think, oh, this is this movie without a plot.
I mean, that's my
conversation we're always having on here.
Yeah. My Die Hard thing is like, will Die Hard ever be as effective as the first time, you know, because so many movies started to rip off. And we talk about that with Pulp Fiction too. It's like, there are certain things, the original looks stale because you've seen either people trump it or you're so bored by it. It's like you forgot the original intent or how influential it was when it first came out.
Yeah. I always used to have this idea that I wanted to make a movie that looked like a Wong Kar-wai movie but was as plot driven and sort of story driven as like an early Chris Nolan movie. Like imagine if Wong Kar-wai had shot Memento. Like how great that would have been.
That feels like a gauntlet that you've just thrown down.
I know.
And what a perfect way to kind of bring it all back.
Yeah. It wouldn't have made nearly as much money.
Well, Ed, you are one of my favorite guests we ever have on this. I'm just so glad that you came back to talk to us about your top three and about everything else that we have talked about today.
Well, thank you for having me. I love talking movies with you guys.
And just so you all know, Reckless is available now. You can order it from your local comic book shop. That's the best way to do it. Call them up. They'll be excited to have you there. And if you can't find it there, you can find it in your local bookshop. You can also find it in any place that you would get a book. I mean, a lot of people recommend like a Powell books and things like that, you know, so there's plenty of places to get it besides the big A.
Yeah, first two, Reckless and Friend of the Devil, are currently out. And on October 20th, Destroy All Monsters, the third Reckless book comes out.
Well, Ed, this has been great. Thank you so, so much. And we will see you next time.
Thank you.